morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Just a couple things I wanted to say. One is we had a terrific time at the PAPS yesterday. They couldn't have been nicer to us, and it was great to meet you and have an important political discussion as this important election gets even closer. So thank you for being with us in a live audience. It was the best of times. Also, more political news. There's a constant political news these days. Tonight at 7, it's the second U.S. Senate debate between Democratic Representative Tammy Baldwin and former Republican Governor Tommy Thompson. You will be able to hear that debate live from Wausau right here on the Ideas Network, or you can go online at WPR.org. It's the second U.S. Senate debate, Tammy Baldwin and Tommy Thompson, tonight at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Nate Silver is with us this hour. Nate Silver has a fascinating book, The Signal and the Noise, Why So Many Predictions Fail, But Some Don't. He is a statistician, a writer. He is founder of the New York Times political blog. And I'm sure that there are some in this audience who go to that blog site every day to see, no, not just every day, several times a day to see if Nate's written something new, 538.com. He comes out of baseball, and he was fabulous in that area. He developed this system for forecasting baseball performance. He has been named one of the world's 100 most influential people by Time Magazine. And if you look at what he had to say about the 2008 election and his accuracy, it is just astounding. So we will find out why during the course of this hour. But he writes about so many things. It's not just politics. He writes about weather forecasting. He writes about the financial collapse and that being a failure of predicting things. He writes about poker and all kinds of things. It's a fascinating read. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 is the number. You can also send messages on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, or you can go to our email, which is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Hi, Nate Silver. Thanks so much for being with us.
Yeah, hi, Kathleen.
So did baseball teach you everything you know?
You learn a lot from baseball, I think. In baseball, you learn how to work with numbers and statistics, and baseball is a very good environment for that because everything that's happened on the Major League playing field since 1876 has been recorded statistically. It has pretty simple rules. It has a lot of history, and so that's kind of where I got my training, really, in how to use these numbers.
So when did you go from baseball to politics?
So I worked for a company, kind of a startup called Baseball Prospectus from about 2003 until 2008. And that was the time Michael Lewis had written Moneyball at about the start of that period. And so that was a kind of very hot topic of discussion in the game at the time, where you had tension between the old ways of doing things and kind of the stat geeks, right? And then there really was a lot of conflict, really was a lot of tension in the air. You go to, like, the annual meetings at that time, but you saw in just a few short years how statistics really changed the way that baseball teams made decisions. It turned out that actually kind of the stats and the scouts are on the same page, just trying to get useful information for their teams about how these young players are gonna do and what they're worth. And so kind of, you know, you saw really a revolution in that discipline, whereas in politics, you turn on the TV and it's not very data-driven at all. Most of the media coverage is very much narrative-driven about kind of who won the day, kind of, you know, who looked good on the campaign trail. A lot of things that I would consider, as I use in the title of my book, kind of noise instead of signal.
Yeah, and what should the signal be? What should we be concentrating on now?
So, you know, you should probably be looking at the polls, although doing so carefully, meaning looking at the polls in plural and what they say collectively, both the national polls and certainly the state polls, and not just focusing on one poll. at the expense of all others.
Mm-hmm. Your book looks, of course, not only at politics, it looks at so many things, which makes it fascinating. A study you write early on of why some predictions succeed and why some fail. Are there certain areas where it is much easier to make predictions than it is others, say politics versus the weather?
So it helps when you have events that occur on an everyday basis. So, look, in some ways, the weather system is a very complex thing to predict, where you're literally trying to create simulations of the Earth's atmosphere and figure out where every kind of cloud formation is and every cold front and every warm front. But they get a lot of practice because you make a forecast every day in every part of the country, and if it turns out to be wrong, and you're like, okay, well, what did I do wrong that time? Maybe I can, through trial and error, learn to get a little bit better. You have that advantage in baseball as well, where you're in the teams who are stubborn about adopting the kind of money ball approach for a while. They kept losing, and the other teams kept winning, and that kind of moved people toward the truth, as I see it, right? But in politics, you only have one election every 4 years. And in any one election, you know, if we have a close election, I'll tell you how our forecast do is going to involve a lot of luck in the near term. In the long term, it balances out, but the long term doesn't happen fast enough in politics. So I think it's hard for us to make a lot of progress.
Well, let's pat you on the back for a moment and then find out how in the world you were able to do this. But when you look at your record of 2008 presidential election, you were almost entirely right, Nate. I mean, people looked at you and said, how did this guy do this? He's really good.
Well, a lot of it is just, you know, some of the stuff we do is more complex. But really, if you were just taking the average of the polls in each state, just a simple average, instead of looking at just one poll, you'd have gotten about 48 of the 50 states right in 2008. So maybe all the extra kind of secret sauce we put in got us one more right. But really, it's more a matter of I think just being pretty good at this is a good counterweight to the pundits you see on TV. In most news coverage, the news coverage wants the horse race
right.
to be a race down to the end. And this year it really is, at least right now. It really is a close race. You don't have to fake it, right? But in 2008, if you looked at the show The McLaughlin Group, this long-running syndicated show where they have supposed experts come on, three of the four experts on election eve 2008 said the race was too close to call, which it wasn't. Obama was up by 7 points in every swing state in 2008, and won as the polls predicted. But you have people who have a disincentive to tell you the truth sometimes when it means worse ratings. So we at least serve as a counterweight to that. If we get a couple extra states right, it's about as well as we think we're going to do over the long run. We'll have some years when we do better and worse. But we think we'll do better than watching TV pundits.
You said the only thing that was an unknown at that point was whether or not race would be a factor when people went to the polls and they just weren't saying whether it would be or not, meaning they wouldn't vote for the president because he was black. But that was the only possible variable in a race that he was bound to win.
Yeah, you would have to have had some. There used to be this phenomenon, called the Bradley effect, which was a number of races during the 1980s. You had African American candidates underperform their polls on election day. A lot of people said, "Oh, you know, I'm undecided," when it was a implicit way of saying I'll vote against the black candidate. But that didn't seem to exist during the Democratic primaries in 2008, where there were some states like New Hampshire where Obama lost relative to his polls, but also a lot of states where he beat his polls, and it didn't pan out in on election day, the general election in November 2008 either. But, you know, you did need some hypothesis like that to explain how Obama would miss his polls by that amount. The election wasn't really too close to call. This one might be, but 4 years ago was a pretty straightforward case.
And before we go to the financial crisis, which I want to talk about, the catastrophic failure of prediction you write about, and it's a fascinating chapter, let's just look at the race right now, because you're Nate Silver and you're on the air with us.
Sure.
So it is very close right now.
It is very close, and we give Obama a slight edge. We have him as about a 65% favorite. And the reason is that if you look in the states that would be decisive in the Electoral College, including Ohio, including Wisconsin, including Iowa, so it's this kind of cluster of Midwestern states, he seems to be ahead by a point or two or three in the polls in those states right now. That's not a big cushion. If he has any more, say, bad debates or bad moments on the campaign trail, it could be very, very vulnerable. But it does seem like he's holding on to that lead in the state polls, even though national surveys say something a bit different. So that's why we have him ahead. It's because of the state-by-state state-by-state polling math.
And what will you be looking at specifically in the next week or 2 weeks? At the state polls to see if there are changes? Will you be looking very carefully at what happens after the next presidential debate, or where are you looking?
Well, so, you know, there are two kind of situations. First of all, you want to figure out if you're in a steady state environment or a moving one, right? Mm-hmm. So over the next two, three days, we're going to be trying to determine, did Obama, who seemed to have the better performance according to polls of people who watched the debate, will that translate into any gains in the head-to-head poll? Sometimes it does, sometimes it does not. But so that's the most important thing to watch over the next couple of days. Once that question is on its way to being resolved, then you turn and focus more to the individual states again. Mm-hmm. But, of course, you have another debate on Monday, so whatever gains he did or didn't make, you'll have another storyline by then. But after that last debate on Monday, then we really are into the stretch run where a lot of it's going to be baked into the cake by that point, right? You're going to be trying to move the numbers by half a point in one state or another, right? But there can be this kind of eerie kind of calm before the storm, where sometimes in the last 2 weeks before the campaign, there's no more events, no more conventions, unless there are real surprises, then it can get slower, and everyone's just kind of very nervously anticipating Election Day.
So what's the date for baked in the cake?
There's no absolute hardcore cutoff, but I would say that the third and final debate is the last chance to go on a national stage and drive the numbers by yourself, right? Other things that would happen would be based on working hard on the ground or how candidates react to news events. If there's another attack in Libya, then obviously that could play into the campaign. But the last guaranteed opportunity that even the President of the United States has to get in the heads of a large number of voters will come in that third and final debate. Certainly also for Mitt Romney as well, who has maybe even less ability than an incumbent president to control the news cycle.
Mm-hmm. Nate Silver is our guest this hour. We're going to welcome phone calls for him, so chime in whenever you'd like. His book, and a fascinating one it is, The Signal and the Noise, Why So Many Predictions Fail, But Some Don't. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Nate is a statistician, writer, founder of the New York Times political blog, 538.com, which if you don't know about, you'll be happy you heard about it today, because you should follow it as we reach the final 2.5 weeks of the presidential campaign. Rick in Madison sends an email to get us going here. Nate, given the increasing accuracy of polling techniques and the bandwagon effect, do you think polls have too much forward influence on elections?
Well, I'm not sure if polls... I mean, polls have been getting more accurate broadly over the course of the past decade or two, but I'm nervous about whether they'll keep doing so, where it's now harder and harder to get people on the phone to respond to surveys. The response rate, as it's called, the polls, is only about 10% now. But, you know, there probably are a few bandwagon voters who want to vote for the candidate who's winning. I think one candidate who certainly did help himself in the debate was Mitt Romney, because people were afraid that his campaign might just kind of drift off. And now people know that he certainly, any vote cast for Mitt Romney is a meaningful vote, where he's close enough that it's very close, obviously, he could win. But I don't know. I think it's more of a factor in the primaries, usually, than in the general election. Remember, in the general election, like 95% of people their minds are made up. They're going to vote based on largely their partisan political views anyway. So there aren't that many swing voters, whereas in the primaries, for example, that late surge that Santorum made in Iowa may actually have been kind of momentum-driven, where there was a CNN poll that came out in Iowa that had Santorum jumping from 10% to 16%, and so there were lots of favorable articles written about him. But that poll could have been an outlier. The Des Moines Register poll of Iowa, which is a really good poll, found that Santorum's numbers did increase, but only after the CNN poll came out, meaning that it was the news coverage maybe that made it a self-fulfilling prophecy. So you have to be a little bit careful when it comes to primaries when voters are switching around between candidates a lot.
How advanced is the science, your science, in terms of, which is what it all comes down to, who's going to go to the polls?
Well, that's where there's a lot of disagreement among the polling firms. It's one thing to try and call everyone on the phone and ask who you're going to vote for, but determining how many of them will turn out is another question. At this point, if Romney wins the election, it will probably be because he gets a better turnout than Obama. If you look at polls of registered voters, then Obama would probably be ahead right now by 3 or 4 points. Not a totally safe margin, but comfortable enough. But polls of likely voters, who are the ones pollsters think will actually turn out, show a nearly tied race. I should add one qualification, though, which is that polls of people who have already voted, which is more and more people, show a big Obama edge. So maybe Republican voters are more enthusiastic. Often the opposition party is. But Democrats may do a better job of coaxing their voters to the polls, and that can be a counterweight to that.
Yeah. Let's go to Christian in Oshkosh. Hi, Christian.
Hi. I want to ask you about Nassan Taleb's book, The Black Swan. Briefly, it's about, I mean, if, you know, but I'm sure that for our listeners, it's about, you know, different domains. For example, in baseball, you're not going to get a guy hitting 1,000 or, you know,
sure,
hitting a 10,000-foot home run. But in certain domains, such as finance or technology, you do see people like Bill Gates, who are so fabulously, you know, so much more fabulously successful than the average that they constitute what he calls a black swan, an unpredictable event that comes and kind of shuffles the deck. So I wanted to hear your take on that and how you account for it and if you think his approach is valid.
Yeah, I think the kind of hypothesis of my book is probably about 98% compatible with his, where he's also talking about the kind of failures of prediction and the limitations of models. And look, not everything follows this kind of nice, normal bell curve distribution where you're never going to be all that far off. But in the stock market, you can have a shock where the market declines, as it did in the 1987 crash, by 20% in one day. Right? And that's very, very different. And whenever you have systems where you have interaction, right? So, for example, the pattern of earthquakes, which is a chapter we talk about in the book, kind of resembles the stock market, where you have big shocks now and then. Usually there's nothing really to measure at all, but you have these big catastrophic events, and that's a property of certain types of complex systems, and it probably describes a lot of things that we're interested in predicting, like the American economy, for example. And that requires, I think, awareness and humility for forecasters. I don't know if I agree with him that literally makes things unpredictable. I see predictability as existing along a spectrum. You always know something, and you don't know other things, and you try and measure where you are along that scale. But basically, I'm kind of the same mind of him for the most part on this stuff.
First chapter of the book, A Catastrophic Failure of Prediction. The financial crisis was a catastrophic failure of prediction. Why?
Well, in two different ways, and it's kind of a slightly double entendre, I guess. But number one, it was catastrophic because the predictions were so far off. Where the single worst prediction I encountered in the book, remember these mortgage-backed securities you heard about in the news? The rating agencies had given AAA ratings to all of these securities, which are pieces of subprime mortgage debt, and the claim was made that, okay, well, these individual mortgages might not be very good, but we have diversification, right? We take mortgages from all over the country, and so we couldn't possibly have a national housing bubble, right? And of course we did. And so these models that said these were very safe were built on assumptions that didn't realize what would happen if you had a housing collapse. And so it's basically like predicting that the weather would be 78 degrees and sunny and you had a blizzard instead. Things that were supposed to have almost no chance of defaulting, almost all of them did downgrade or did default. And it was also catastrophic because it meant that the American taxpayer wound up having to suffer a lot and bail out some of these companies because of poor decisions that these rating agencies and that the banks were making. And so it was catastrophic both in terms of human scale and in terms of how bad the predictions were relative to how good they were supposed to be.
Mm-hmm. Do you put money in the stock market?
I do, but I don't really do anything terribly fancy. If you read the book The Intelligent Investor by Benjamin Graham, he basically tells you to take whatever money you want to invest, take 90% of it and just put it in index funds where it follows the overall market. It's really hard to beat the market or whatever bonds you want to buy. And then if you want to have, if you want to make more daring types of bets, then take 10% of your investments and do whatever you want with it. But for the most part, I'm a pretty pretty conservative investor. I like to make predictions in fields like politics, where frankly I don't think the average competitor is all that sophisticated, right? But I know that I'm not just going to come in and kind of do a couple of hours of work in my spare time and beat lots of professionals on Wall Street who are doing this for a living, which is not to say they can't make mistakes. They can make gigantic mistakes, obviously. But I would need to kind of make a career out of it myself before I'd be bold enough to think I wouldn't make the same mistakes myself.
Yeah. You also do, just to, because you're an intriguing guy, you do fantasy football, but no longer fantasy baseball. Is that right?
Yeah, I stopped doing fantasy baseball a couple of years ago because it felt too much like, at the time I was kind of running about baseball for a living, and it felt too much like work, right? So there was no more joy. I had too high expectations for myself again. But fantasy football, I did grow up in Michigan. I grew up in the Midwest, so you still have the kind of tradition of it's kind of your church as you kind of watch football on Sundays no matter what. So that's still a time for me to relax and have fun.
Scott is next in lacrosse. Hi, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen.
Hi.
I want to take you back to a baseball bet. Do you still follow baseball, though? Watch it?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I don't get as much time as I would like during election years. I know I missed a lot of this terrific postseason. But
the reason I'm asking is that I only recently discovered Moneyball and read the book and then watched the movie and, was really excited to see the Oakland A's getting into the playoffs.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sitting back thinking, oh, this is going to be great. I'm going to see Moneyball, just played as it was described, where on-base percentage means everything, and anathema to Billy Bean was bunting and stealing bases. And then, lo and behold, I'm sitting in front of the TV watching Coco Crisp stealing bunting to get on and stealing second, and I'm thinking, this isn't the money ball I was expecting, and I wondered, has something changed? I know this is about a dozen-year-old story Lewis actually followed the A's, but, I mean, has something changed? Aren't the numbers still the numbers, and why wouldn't Billy? I would just imagine, from the way the book was written, that Billy Bean, under the way a description like this of this kind of bunting and stealing, he'd be in the weight room in the Coliseum throwing bats against the wall. So what's gone on?
So Moneyball isn't really about, it's not about on-base percentage. It's not about any one type of stat or any one type of player so much as where is the market inefficiency. And when Moneyball was written 10 years ago, teams were clearly undervaluing on-base percentage and walks and overvaluing skills like speed. The problem now is that Moneyball has become the textbook kind of way to build a team now, and it's how the Yankees and the Cardinals and the Red Sox think about things. So there's no longer necessarily an edge in finding that type of player. In fact, maybe there's more of an edge in taking players who are good defensive players, which is harder to measure, and if you have a good way of doing it, you can have an advantage there potentially. So, I talked to Billy Bean for the book, and he said, look, that book was great, but it made my job a lot harder, right? Because the stuff that we're doing, everyone else is doing now as well, so they're trying to find different ways to innovate, and ironically, they're kind of almost going back to more of the old kind of pitching and defense formula. Maybe everyone else has overcompensated just a tiny bit because they've gotten so much more information about kind of what the right way to value these different stats are is.
It's vindication and it's curse, huh?
Yeah, exactly, right? I mean, if you do anything successful, that's the beauty and the failure, I guess, of the kind of the capitalist economy, right? If you have a great idea, then someone else will duplicate it after you profit from it for a while, right? And that might help kind of the industry as a whole, but it also means that you have to have another good idea every couple of years to stay ahead of the competition.
Still, Scott, the best story in baseball this year, though, the Giants, do you think?
Oh, gosh, Kathleen, I'm from the Bay Area, so...
All right.
you're making it hard on me right now. The Cardinals are such a machine. They're the champions, and I'm really right now. I'm expecting to be rooting for the Tigers against the Cardinals. Mm. I respect the Cardinals, but I can't root for them. You know, because the Brewers.
Right, right.
But I do respect them as opposed to the Yankees.
Right.
Thanks, you're a great guest. I appreciate it.
Thanks,
a lot.
Scott. Thanks Bye. For the call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. Nate Silver is our guest this hour. Nate has a book, The Signal and the Noise: Why So Many Predictions Fail, but Some Don't, and it goes way beyond politics. He, of course, covers politics, but he looks at weather and he looks at earthquakes and he looks at political pundits and the crash of last year and all of that, or 2008. So he is with us to talk about the world of predictions this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. And you can always go to our Facebook page, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Just a reminder, U.S. Senate debate tonight, Thursday, October 18, on the Ideas Network. They are debating in Wausau, Tammy Baldwin and Tommy Thompson. And you can also go online if you'd like to hear it that way, which is WPR.org. Nate Silver is our guest this hour. Patrick in Greenfield, hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Nate, I'm kind of curious. I do this whenever I get called frequently. For political polls, I give them intentionally incorrect information because I think that political polling is actually doing a great harm to our country. It's not telling them anything as far as the politicians are concerned, what they should be doing, which is basically figuring out the right solutions. Instead, they're watching the poll numbers as much as everybody else, and it seems like everybody's trying to figure out who's going to be the winner, not who should be the winner.
Well, it's I guess I'm not really a fan of of politics either. You know, I like elections. I think they're an interesting problem, kind of intellectually, but it's not meant to endorse. I don't like the stuff where people say when a candidate has a very clever way of misleading voters on the campaign trail, people say, "Oh, the art of politics." I'm not really a big fan of that exactly. I do think that people do cover the horse race, cover the who's up and who's down angle, and if you're going to do that, then I think there's a better way to do that. But yeah, it is the case, by the way, that people who respond to polls are in some ways not that normal. Most people won't take a pollster's phone call, or like you maybe. If they do, they don't feel all that compelled to give a serious answer. And so it's one of the ambiguities we have in trying to predict this stuff, is you're trying to infer from what the 10% of people who do answer polls seriously say and hope that they represent the broader population. It's worked pretty well in the past couple of elections, but you know, sooner or later we're probably going to have a big disaster.
Kenneth is next in Gainesville. Hi, Kenneth.
Hello. What about the situation of the cell phone versus landline situation? Is that problem taken care of? Or
So if right now about a third of American households have only a cell phone, they don't have a landline at all. There's another group that has a landline. I got a landline with my cable package, but I don't use it except to do actually radio interviews at home, right? So if you don't call cell phones, you're going to miss maybe a third to a half of voters. That's not a very scientific survey, in my view, if you're missing that many people. But the good news is that most of the major news organizations, most of the higher quality state polls are calling cell phones as well as landlines right now. There are a few polls that don't, some of the cheaper ones. They tend to be more favorable for Mitt Romney than the ones that do call cell phones. So those polls might have a little bit of a bias where they undercount Democratic voters. But again, you can look toward the higher quality polls, and they are including cell phones most of the time.
What's 538 looking at today? Are you writing today, Nate?
I am. We're going to talk about one theme we've had recently with the election being so close is how do you process these contradictory streams of information? So the Gallup poll as of yesterday had Romney 6 points ahead,
mm-hmm.
Which is different than any other national poll shows that are different than the impression you get from the state polls. And so we're going to talk about how to see that poll. I think sometimes people do the exact opposite of what they should, which is that they put more emphasis on the outlier instead of saying, you know what, there are a lot of polls out there. Some of them are going to do funny things based on the laws of chance, the different methods that pollsters use, and it's kind of more the data that you should not focus on the extreme cases. But people like to bicker and argue about them. My phrase is that every poll is guilty and even innocent. you should not start on saying, oh, this poll must be true. Let me prove that it's wrong. It's like, no, all this data is hard to get the exact result right. And when you collect it all together, when you get rid of some of that noise, then you get a fairly useful indicator of where the election is headed.
Yeah.
But if a poll looks like an outlier, you should assume that it usually is, because that's how it usually happens in the end.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about the use of prediction and how it might help us in all aspects of life and how we learn more about it. We did a show on the Milwaukee Art Museum and their terrific exhibit that they have, which is Rembrandt and Van Dyck and Gainsborough, and they're getting a lot of people there. But the person who was a curator of the exhibit was thinking, you know, this information might be real helpful as we put together exhibits. Is there any way for us to predict if people are going to come through the front door to see our exhibit? And it got me thinking, well, that could be useful information for a whole variety of different fields. Is there a way for us to become more skilled at predictions, Nate? And if so, what is it?
Well, it requires, I think, so the book talks about the gap between kind of what we know and what we think we know. And on the one hand, there are ways to apply more data-driven techniques to get better at prediction, especially in fields where you do have a lot of data, and there are cases where different types of businesses have a lot of information about their customers and how to target them. You know, frankly, political campaigns are one application of this, for better or for worse, for the Obama campaign or the Romney campaign. If you're in Wisconsin and you show up on their radar, they know a creepy amount of stuff about you, right?
Mm-hmm.
But for better or worse, so do a lot of different companies, so do Google and everything else, and they're using that data to customize things more and more. If you go to see the ads now that you see served when you do a Google search, are often highly personalized based on what your interests are. And of course, so, you know, a lot of these technologies can be applied to either good or evil purposes. At the same time, there are other cases where the data is not very reliable. We talked about how difficult it is to actually measure, for example, how the American economy is doing. You know, politics is a field which is somewhere in between. There's some predictability, but you also encounter some difficulties. And so, knowing the difference between where these techniques are likely to produce big returns and where we're kind of banging our heads up against the wall, we just have to say, well, this is as well as we can do. We have to prepare for a wider range of outcomes of scenarios.
Mm-hmm. Have you looked at the field of global warming at all?
Yeah, we talk about global warming. In the book, yes, and it's a kind of a complex case where it is a very complex thing to predict potentially. Where you're trying to create a model of the entire climate many years in advance. And one of the challenges is that we're really interested in what the planet's going to look like 20 or 25 years from now, but you can't really test those predictions until it's too late. At the same time, people should remember that the science behind the greenhouse effect, behind global warming, is very simple. The greenhouse effect has been understood for many, many years, and carbon is a particle when it's released in the atmosphere that reflects heat back on to the Earth's surface and warms the planet. Now, the exact effects that might have, that is fairly difficult to predict, but we do know that if we keep emitting carbon in the atmosphere, it's going to make the planet warmer, and you know, we might want to take steps to either mitigate the amount of carbon emissions or make sure we have a handle on the risks that presents.
We go to Mark next in Madison. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Nate. How are you?
Good, thank you.
I can't tell if you can hear me or not.
We can hear you.
I can hear you,
okay,
yeah.
Okay, very fine. I have a question you may have touched on a little bit, but I'd like to get to the at the end of the day, you're really dealing with information and the integrity in the information. And here's the example. You use the baseball statistics, which go back to the late 1800s, and there's a lot of integrity there because it's observational, it's recorded, there's decades and decades of hard data. And then you get into the political realm where there's an element of not only some subjectivity, but there's different sources of the information. And then at the last extreme, the black swan event, and this is the financial collapse 4 or 5 years ago, where we found out after the fact that a lot of the information, particularly from the rating services, was just bogus. I mean, it was just bad information, and in some instances, possibly illegal, borderline unethical information. But how do you sit down at the end of the day and make a determination on the statistical, on the numbers that you've got, the data that you've got, is whether or not it is accurate? And I'll hang up and take the answer off the air because I'm driving.
Thank you, Mark.
Well, Mark, I would just say that the way that you're framing this problem is something that people have to think a lot more about. Are you in a data-rich environment like baseball, or a kind of data-poor environment like, say, predicting these new securities that have never existed before, or somewhere in between like politics? Because your attitudes will change a lot depending on where you are on that spectrum. I think people don't adjust for that enough when they're making forecasts, right? In a very data-rich field like baseball, maybe the lay person is shocked by how well we can predict things, whereas in economics, people are maybe stunned by how poorly the predictions do. When you see the monthly jobs reports, people are always stunned if, say, there's supposed to be 120,000 jobs out of the payrolls number and you get 150,000 instead or 70,000. Historically, the margin of error on that number, and it is a survey, by the way, just like a political poll is about plus or minus almost 150,000, 200,000, right? Which means you can have these gigantic misses all the time. People don't realize that as much. So the book, among other things, tries to look at the history of in which fields predictions have worked and in which they haven't, and what the commonalities are between them, so people kind of know more the degree of difficulty before they go about trying to either make predictions or rely on predictions that other people are making as well.
And thanks very much for the call. Nate Silver is our guest this hour. Nate has a book now in addition to his 538 blog, which is well worth reading, particularly during this election time, down to the crunch, down to the almost election. His book is The Signal and the Noise, Why So Many Predictions Fail, But Some Don't. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. You can always send an email to talk@WPR.org, or our Facebook page where you can leave us messages is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have some lines open for you if you want to get through. Now would be a good time for you to call 800-486-8655. A couple of emails have come in, Nate. Rick in Madison writes, that's not Paul in Barron County. We already got to Rick. Paul in Barron County, how much influence does the news have on national voting?
Well, it depends on what type of news events. I think sometimes if you watch kind of the mainstream media coverage, it tends to flatten the scale too much, where some irrelevant campaign trail development is treated with the same importance as maybe a foreign policy crisis or something like that. I think the average voter is actually fairly good at filtering out the important items from the unimportant ones. Certainly at this point, people have the basic story of the economy down, where it's not in recession, it's also not growing very fast. They probably have some basic impressions about foreign policy. So I think it would take a major news event to really change the course of things.
How much did the first debate in this presidential election change the course of things?
a lot. And the debates are a time where these kind of set pieces, as I would call them in the campaign, meaning the conventions, the debates, are very important. So one time where you're guaranteed to have a large audience of voters, and including undecided voters. But Romney's position before the debates was pretty dire, where he was about 5 points down in the polls on October 1st. And if you look at candidates that were down by a substantive margin in the polls on October 1st, and go back to all the way back to 1936 when you start getting the first political polls, they'd only come back to win the election two times out of 20. So that was about 10% odds. Our model had more complex ways of figuring things out. It had Romney's odds down to about 15%. And now, now he's recovered to where the election is very, very close. And we still think he's a little bit behind based on the state polls, but clearly within striking distance if he has a strong a third debate, if anything else breaks against Obama in the news cycle, or, you know, close enough that we're going to be sweating the outcome on election day probably no matter what, where the polls can be off by a point or two in Ohio very, very, very easily, and then Romney will be the next president potentially.
And the second debate, will we see polls reflect that, and is that as important as the first?
Potentially. Look, I think the bounce that Romney got out of the Denver debate is unlikely to be entirely counteracted by Obama. But, you know, all the debates are there's the most important events that we have left, but we'll have to wait a couple more days before we can tell in the polls whether Obama got a lift out of that debate. My expectation is that he might add a point or so, which isn't a lot, but is worth something when it's nearly a tied race, getting an extra point in your favor can shift the odds quite a bit.
Greg in Minocqua, hi.
Yeah, hi. I've been wondering for quite some time about specifically the Y2K situation and the predictions that obviously went wrong when you would think that they would be fairly simple, since you're essentially just predicting computer behavior. And I'm wondering if you could talk about anything you might know about what happened with that situation.
Well, one thing that's difficult with any kind of any kind of security problem, anything that would allow you to, where you're trying to intervene to prevent some kind of crisis, then it can be a self-canceling prediction, right? Where if we hadn't taken all those steps to fix Y2K problems, then maybe you would have had severe flaws. You can never know for sure, but this is another difficulty where, for example, in terrorism, if you're doing a good job, if our intelligence analysts are doing a good job of anticipating where the terrorist threats might be, then you prevent them before they occur. So you don't get any credit for that necessarily. Or likewise, when you have, we talk about the spread of the flu in the book, where if you know that a flu strain is dangerous and you shut down schools as a result and encourage people to behave in more healthful ways, then that can prevent the outbreak that you were scared about in the first place. I think we have to be careful about these averted disasters potentially when people are taking steps and intervening in the experiment.
Thanks, Greg, for your call. David in Madison, hi.
Thank you. My question had to do with the variable of money in U.S. House races, especially late. And I'll preface this by saying I understand you called all U.S. Senate races in 08, and you were 49 out of 50 in the presidentials. I'm really curious if you missed, Missouri, Indiana, or North Carolina. But in any event, with the House races, I actually was a candidate myself a number of years ago in a House race, and we were down 49 to 34 with 6 weeks out. The National Committee determined that there's no way we could win, even though if you have some money, you get your name known, you can usually get 3 out of 4 votes against an incumbent who's polling less than 50%. 2 years later, somebody was in a similar situation, just a couple points closer, and the DCCC, which is the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, poured in massive amounts of money so that there was able to be local television advertising, and the challenger eked out a razor-thin victory over the longtime incumbent. So my question is, how do you predict and what's your success rate at the U.S. House level? Because I would think with that late infusion of money or maybe other factors of which I'm not aware, you have a tougher time calling those.
So we did we do race-by-race House predictions only in off years of the presidency because it's just too much to handle otherwise. We did do them in 2010. I think of the 435 races, I think we got like 416 right or something, which sounds impressive, but a lot of those are gimmies in very Republican or Democratic-leaning districts. But, yeah, House races are tricky to forecast, and the polls are often not very good at all. So that's where you really need to look at more types of information. Fundraising information is often a very good indicator of the status of the race. Looking at the overall partisan climate in the district, we found that looking at the candidates' qualifications, you've had someone who's run for office before, they tend to do a little bit better, especially if they've won before. So you have to kind of throw a lot at that problem to try and approach it. But yeah, House predictions are another thing entirely. You have a lot of data. You have 435 races every year, so you can be, in some ways, it's a pure application of statistical modeling. But boy, some of the polls in House races are really far off.
Jean in Wauwatosa, hi.
Hi, good morning. Thanks. Say, I'm wondering on the low-informed voters, do you have any information on that? And do they just tune in for debates and they don't follow the primaries? Also, do you have any predictions on Ryan's congressional seat?
I would think Paul Ryan would retain his congressional seat. I mean, you know, polls actually show in that district of Wisconsin, the Romney-Ryan ticket winning. You know, I think what you might see is if he lost, then it could be more trouble in 2 years from now in 2014, potentially. But, you know, the typical low-information voter is going to watch some of the debates, maybe one or two convention speeches. And so that's why those events are so important. I think if you're in the news media, as I am in New York or people in D.C., they lose touch with the fact that most people have everyday lives, and they're not following every political development,
right.
And they tune in only at certain times. And that's why, you know, that's why Mitt Romney had his best day of the campaign in that debate stage in Denver. And that's the time to do it, when the spotlight is on you.
And what percentage of us are in that low information category?
Well, I don't know if this is a precise cutoff point. Remember, a lot of lower information voters don't vote at all. But, you know, I'd probably say that maybe a third of the population won't really think very much about their the election, except for, you know, seeing a few ads and seeing the conventions and so on and so forth. But yeah, a lot of people aren't following the nitty-gritty of politics every day that your listeners might be, for example.
I know. Maybe, I don't, it's too much at this point, but I'm glad we're informed. And email from somebody wondering what state you got wrong in 2008.
So it was Indiana. We had Indiana McCain favored and Obama won instead, which may be a testament, among other things, to Obama's turnout, where I lived in Chicago at the time. And I knew a lot of people were being kind of bussed down to Gary, Indiana, to knock on doors and get people out to vote there. And so a candidate can sometimes outperform their polls by a point or two based on having a good ground game. It won't resolve everything, but it wasn't surprising that it was a state that we missed. At the same time, I would say that you know, you're lucky anytime you get 49 out of 50 rate. Right. This is. We think this is a science, but it's certainly not an exact science. So you cross your lucky stars when you have a year like that.
And can you look at how successful, how well organized a ground game is? Is that an important part of predicting who will show up on election day? Does it factor into the race in any way?
Yeah. So, you know, this is one hidden potential positive for Obama and negative for for Romney, is that Obama tended to beat his numbers by a point or two in the polls in swing states in 2008. He didn't really do it in non-swing states, in non-competitive states, which suggests that it might have something to do with his ground game and his turnout operation. If you look at polls of people who have already voted, Obama seems to be quite a bit ahead with them. And so that would be the one thing, because Romney needs a very good turnout to win this election. And I'm not sure if he has the same ground game that Bush and Roe built to two election wins in 2000 and 2004, or that Obama did in 2008. The GOP, for some reason, de-emphasized that a lot under McCain. I think Romney's quite a bit better organized than McCain. But probably not as well as Obama.
Mm. But you can depend on Republicans more to vote than on Democrats, can't you?
That's true, but right now, well, we'll see where the polls move. If you have the election today, then we talked about this this likely voter versus registered voter
right.
thing, where Obama would probably win among registered voters. So that means if both parties get a good get a good turnout, then Obama will probably win. So Romney needs for him to get a good turnout, and you know, probably is within his control. It probably will happen. But if Obama gets one as well, then Romney will have his work cut out for him on Election Day.
Yeah, let's do this in 40 seconds. Last call, if we can. Ben in Madison. Hi.
Hello.
Yeah, Ben, go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah, we'll have to skip that. Ben, you got your radio on, and we don't have time to take care of all of that. Well, Nate, thank you so much for being with us. Your book is absolutely fascinating. It covers so many areas we never got into because the presidential race is pressing, but it was a great hour. I think you should come to our house sometime. My husband is a baseball reporter who spends the whole off season doing baseball statistics, and all of the boys are into exactly the same things you are, so you could just come and be one of us if you're in Milwaukee.
Well, my parents met at Madison, right? So they're in school there. So I have Wisconsin kind of roots.
Good. All right. Thanks, Nate.
Great. Thank you.
Nate's book is The Signal in the Noise, Why So Many Predictions Fail, But Some Don't. The book has just been published. He also, for those of you who haven't been to it, is the founder and the writer of 538.com. New York Times blog, and he's looking at interesting aspects of the election. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Brett Jaspers for producing this program, and thanks everybody for all of your calls. A reminder, the second Senate debate will be tonight. We'll be airing it here on the Ideas Network. It's from Wausau, live from Wausau. It's tonight at 7. Have a terrific weekend. We'll be with you Monday at 9 for all things political.